How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists. Hopefully things work since technically I have a new computer.
Well, ish. Is it the new computer or is it just a rebuilt computer?
It's not like they didn't change it. They changed the display because apparently my monitor was kind of going to crap. Mm. And they ran a bunch of tests and they said they fixed some things, some little glitches. And then I just reinstalled the software and everything again. We'll see.
So is it running quicker now than it was before?
I really honestly got it back yesterday. I haven't been on it. I did a little day drinking yesterday, so not much happened in the afternoon.
So what have you done so far today?
Oh, well, today I've been extremely productive. I woke up and looked at an Instagram account that I follow for workouts and stuff just to get some new ideas. And I follow this one chick, Sarah Bomer. Something like that. I think she does some kind of MMA style fighting, but also does like weightlifting competitions and stuff. And so she had this like great lower body workout. And I don't know, I woke up feeling like a badass and was like, let me go do this. But on the way to go do that, I stopped at Lowe's to buy a leaf blower, only a leaf blower, folks, and left with, I don't even want to tell you how much money I spent on plants. Because it was sunny and it was warm and it was beautiful and I'm a sucker and I love plants. So went for a leaf blower, left with so much more. So when I did this, you know, badass workout this morning and then I was like, I am exhausted. Oh, I have so many plants to go plant now. Oops. It's been a long, very intensive, like work intensive, body intensive day.
Well, that's good though. But
yeah.
Who's going to take care of your plants when you're traveling all about?
Well, they're succulents, so which is why I get them, because they are hardy and they don't need a lot of water.
Succulents.
I don't know why that face is.
I don't understand that word, succulents.
I guess, I don't know if succulents would grow in your area anyway, so why don't you just Google search that?
I will.
There's many types. I got some chicken hens, and I got some sedum, and I got, so I already have a bunch back there because I'm trying to, I did hardscapes in my backyard, so it's all rocks and pavers, and then this, like, ground cover that's going to be super hardy and doesn't need much water once it's established, so all it needs is some good drainage, and that's it, so.
Great. Well, for our listeners out there, let me read what a succulent is.
Oh, there you go. Good job.
They're plants that have some parts that are more than normally thickened and fleshy, usually to retain water in arid climates or soil conditions. So there you go.
They're kind of, they're next to sometimes, at least the indoor succulents are, next to the cacti, cactuses. Is it cacti? Cactuses.
Cacti.
Cacti, I was correct the first time.
Yeah.
Yay.
You should have just went with that.
I should have, yeah. But I'm not around that cacti very often, so I don't have to use that in my vernacular. It's not a part of my world right here in Charleston with lots of green.
You know, one of my favorite places to visit, though, is Arizona. I love it. And every time I go there, they have some gorgeous cacti there. And they have a ton of different kinds, but the big, giant, majestic ones, which I don't even know the name of them. I feel like it starts with an S, but whatever, it doesn't matter. Anyways, they always, like, I look at them, I'm like, that is so beautiful. And I look at flowers, I'm like, eh, take it or leave it for the flowers. But cacti, they do it for me.
I don't know. It depends on my mood. I'm so used to green and lush and beautiful flowers blooming all the time. Like last weekend in Charleston, when I was with you in Seattle or near you in Seattle, it was the Flower Town Festival.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Which I'm very happy to be gone from, because last weekend there was at least 60,000 plus people that came to Charleston to do the Cooper River Bridge Run and the Flower Town Festival.
Interesting.
I just can't even stay in this town.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people.
Well, one day I'll come visit it. One day. Maybe 2018. That sounds like a good... Oh, no. 2018, we'll be there.
Yeah,
anyways.
You're going to Edisto, which is like 45 minutes from
How do you say it? Edisto?
Edisto? Okay. How are you saying it?
Oh, I didn't say it. Like, in my head, it was like Edisto. But like
Edisto?
Yeah.
Edisto.
Okay.
Yeah. Edisto Beach.
I don't think I've actually had to verbalize that to anybody yet, because we just started talking about it. So anyways, yeah, so that's what we're planning.
Edisto Beach is great. Lots of dolphins.
What's a good time of year to go?
You know what is so funny? I just had this conversation yesterday because today was 75 and sunny and beautiful. Yesterday was 69 and the other morning it was a high of 50 something. Like, there is no rhyme or reason. I could give you a month and it would be a pretty consistent month. And then maybe that year it's just like, the worst weather ever. Like, there's no consistency.
How about like summertime?
February? Oh, it's just get ready for hot. Just be hot.
No, that's fine.
And get ready for storms.
No, we're okay with hot, but tell me about the storms, like tropical storms. Like,
yeah, as long as you're okay with afternoon thunderstorms, lightning that'll come through because it'll get so hot.
Yeah.
That it just has to like cool itself down.
Sure.
But it's actually pretty nice. I mean, summertime is of course my favorite time. Mm. And like February was gorgeous. Like we had a beautiful February, and of course I wasn't in Charleston the whole February. And then March was kind of like a up and down, and then now it's pretty decent.
Yeah.
But Easter's next weekend. So we always have some kind of weird weather at Easter.
Oh.
Always.
Interesting.
Almost consistently.
Well, I think we'll probably try and plan for the summer then. Because I think, the kids are in school anyways. And I know that, my oldest boy, he doesn't like to miss school. Like, he gets, not emotional, but he really, really hates it. Yeah, he wants to have, the perfect attendance awards, which he is actually. I know the listeners are probably tired of me talking about this, but, my son is freaking amazing, and he's kind of a weirdo, and he likes to impress teachers and impress everyone. And so anyway, I think he's on track to win it this year.
I think that's great for him, because I wish that my nephews would be like more into school.
Yeah.
My one, the oldest one is, a little bit more of a thinker. I kind of liken him to me, like just ask why. And today he found a turtle, like it's maybe the size of a quarter.
Yeah.
And, they were trying to figure out like, how do we keep him? I was like, well, let's maybe not keep him, 'cause you probably stole him from his mom. Aww. But if we're going to, I like to bring the truth to the boy, but I was like, well, let's research it. Like, let's see what we have. He's like, could we do that right now? Let's research it, Auntie. He was like so excited. So that makes me excited.
Well, I think you have to foster
but
that.
But I think that's great that you're... Yeah, well, exactly. And he does not get any fostering outside of me to do that. So I think that's really good for you and Allison as parents, though, that your kid wants to do well and perform and be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely very lucky in that way. And I don't know. I like to think that it's rubbing off on the other two kids too, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, but the oldest is always different.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's why Michael and I are kindred souls. Whatever. Shout out to Mike.
Whatever. Yeah, I just saw him actually this week. This week I put in 84 hours. But I mean, just so everyone knows, it's not like I'm putting in 84 hours like bending over in patients' mouths. It's I get drive time as well. So I calculate that because that's like in my when you look on your timesheet, that's what it says on there. I had 84 hours, including all my drive time. I went.
Do you get paid your? That might be the wrong salary or question, but
that's okay.
You do for driving.
I'll just say this: our company is very generous, and the drive time is included. And I worked in 5 different offices this week because my doctor's out on paternity leave. It's his first child and stuff like that. So I was in my office on Monday, and then I went 3 hours away to another office. And I didn't bring any extra clothes. So I came back to my house afterward, went back up to a place called Kent, which is another 3 hours away, and then came back. And then they said, oh, yeah, well, you can go to Olympia, but I didn't have any clothes again. So I went back again. And so I got like back and forth driving only because they didn't tell me ahead of time. Because my doctor was like day by day canceling the next day. Otherwise, I would have taken 3 sets of clothes and whatever. So it was a lot of late nights.
I think I told you in the middle of the week, though, they make these things. They're like called washing machines. You just throw your stuff in there and you dry them and they come out and they're like fresh and new. I know. It's crazy.
I just have a problem like hanging out in the laundromat in my underwear. You know what I mean? Like it's just... They might have a problem with it too.
you'd have to go to like a hotel that does like... laundry service or something.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I probably could have figured something out, but, plus out,
but it's also nice to go home and see your family.
I do like my kids, even though they were asleep every time I came back,
good for you.
But whatever.
Aww. I just actually want to follow that up with the fact that this week alone on Facebook, I saw 3 different posts where people were being forced to clock out during like lunchtime meetings and or getting paid half the salary. So feel free to send your hate mail to Andrew.
Yeah. And then I'll feel sorry for you, but I'm
that's
not.
A good deal.
Yeah.
You got a sweet deal.
I've been in that situation though before, you know, and I don't want to encourage people just like mass exodus, leave where they're at, but you do need to keep looking for something that's right for you. And finally I found it.
I actually want to talk to Cindy Purdy, a little bit more because she posted this week, it was a little article, but then, her comment, which I was like, high five. What a great comment was, do you want to get out of the op or do you want to change the environment of the op? Maybe it's not that you should be leaving, but maybe there's something that you could actually learn to communicate to your doctor, to your dentist, to your office manager, to whoever that could help facilitate a change. So maybe there are a lot of good things and that's just the one crappy thing. There's got to be a way to change that somehow. And then following up with that is that I just read RDH this month. I think it was Diane. Is it Watterson?
Glasgow Watterson. Yeah.
Okay. I just want to hope I'm saying it right. She gave really excellent advice in her article about just having really good conversations. So if you have RDH, I don't know what month. It's April 9th. Whatever article or magazine would be out on this date, go read that because it was really excellent.
Interesting.
So sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just I was reading another thread online today about they were talking about what they asked. They asked, what does everyone make per hour? And everyone was kind of listing, you know, what they have. Some people are making $25 an hour. And I'm like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah, but where are they?
Yeah, no, it's just, I think it's in the South, I think. But, and then this one person posted, she said, I make like $43 an hour. I get 6 weeks of paid vacation. I get 7 personal days. I get this and this and this and this, paid CE, paid this, paid that. And I was like, you know what? That's awesome because it's nice to hear.
You're like, damn.
No, I'm good. I don't even care. Like, I don't even care what she's getting. And it is probably equivalent to what I have somewhere. I mean, she gets more vacation, but that's pretty much it. But the thing that I liked the most of what she said was you know, she could, and but she drives 45 minutes one way, 45 minutes back. Mm-hmm. And then if it's, you know, bad weather, whether it's going to be an hour. And she said, I could give all that up, but the benefits are so good. And so I could probably make more per hour somewhere else, but the benefits are so good. So make sure you're calculating the benefits packages in all of what you're doing too, because you might only make, you know, in my area, it'd be great to make $40 an hour, but you only might only make $35 an hour with a company like mine, but then you get a crap ton of benefits too.
There's so many other things with it. Mm-hmm. And I think too is like, I want to calculate value into it. Mm. Are you valued in your office? Because I feel like that's priceless.
Yeah.
I would actually make a lot less if I felt like I was valued and a co-therapist within my office.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that's huge.
But kind of talking, going back to what you said, Cindy Purdy was saying about, you know, communications and changing and bringing things to the dentist rather than just kind of exiting just because you don't like it. I mean, you should really be working towards making your environment better, but also knowing that there really are other things outside the op. And I think that's kind of what we talked about in our interview today too, is, you know, if you've done everything that you can, you've tried to really work with your doctor / if it's corporate, you work with, you know, your managers and things, and it's still just not working out for you. I mean, there are other things.
Yeah, absolutely. And today, like you said, today's interview is just about that. It's with a dentist that I was just so lucky to be introduced to by the wonderful Tracy Butler that I love and adore. His name is Tony Stefanou, is the proper way. I say Stefano a lot, though. and he's in New York. I met him at Greater New York. And as soon as we started chatting, I was like, oh, you need to meet Andrew and you need to be on this podcast. Like, you have good things to deliver and say, and just good thinking points. Like, do you really want to get out of the op? Because this is what you could expect. And then also, I think he's a little bit of an advocate for us dental professionals in this corporate world, because he's like asking them to be a little realistic. And he talks about that in the interview today.
He works on kind of both sides of it. He works with you as the dental professional, but he also works with the companies on their side saying, hey, these people are qualified, educated. These people are the type of people that you want representing your company because they are so good. And he loves hygienists. We've been having a slew of doctors though lately, it feels like.
Well, yeah.
They all love hygienists. It's very, this is great.
Well, I don't think we would have one on that didn't love hygienist, but
we might.
And I actually met somebody. We might.
I don't know. I think it'd be fun just to liven it up a little bit.
That outright thinks we're the most annoying people in the practice. Yes. That would be, I don't know if that would end well. I think it would just be the most explicit podcast yet.
Oh, that'd
so be
great.
I'd be so mad.
It'd be so good.
But I did come across a story of a periodontist who is a lecturer and internationally known, that pretty much came off the podium one time. It's like, I could tell hygienists whatever. Who cares? They don't know. Which honestly, I'd say a majority probably wouldn't know, because he's the doctor and he's lecturing to us, and therefore we should believe the things he's saying to us. But that's also why I think that I just cannot drill into my students hard enough that, especially now they're about to graduate, please, for the love of God, do your own research. Mm-hmm. Be informed, ask questions, be a critical thinker for the love of all evidence-based dentistry. Be a critical thinker. So, great interview today. And I think we probably would love to have him on. He was losing his voice, and he talks about that. So maybe we should catch him when he has a voice.
I think so, too. It'll be really good. Hope you guys enjoy this interview.
Hey, Michelle.
Yeah?
It's time for the interview.
Oh, but I had something else to say.
We need to let the experts talk now.
Fine. So, listeners, interview portion of whatever episode this ends up being. We're still at Chicago Midwinter. That's why you're going to hear the background noise and things like that. And it's apparently lunchtime, so people are really loud and chatty right now. But we have another doctor, which is, you know, we're a hygiene podcast, and we keep getting more doctors. But we picked them specially because they're doctors that love hygienists.
They're very pro-hygienists.
Very pro-hygienists. And so this is Dr. Tony Stefanou. Do I say that right?
You
or
did.
Do you say Stefano?
Pretty close. It depends on whom my family you ask. We all pronounce it differently.
So. Okay, because I always say Stefano, so I'm glad.
The easiest way to do it is Stefanu. So new as in something that's new as opposed to old.
Uh-huh.
So Stefanu is the way I pronounce it.
Oh.
My mom would disagree with that, but, you know. She's not going to be listening today, so I can
say that. Oh, you can say that. Yeah. So kind of give us a little bit of background about how long you've been doing this, why you like hygienists, and then also what you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, I have, I will say this, I've been in the industry 30 years, and where I am now is not where I was planning to be.
No.
You know, I think most people that go to dental school or dental hygiene school, you're doing it for the right reasons, and you're going to be practicing for a very long time. And, you know, in the old days, dentists used to practice till they basically dropped. You know,
yeah.
I have to say, you know, getting into the industry, there was a reason why I got into dentistry, and I've now been around, as a matter of fact, we're having our 30-year dental school reunion in May. So, you know, I'm a graduate of Tufts up in Boston, and got out at exactly 30 in 1987, and did what most dentists do, and that was worked as an associate for a while, and then, interestingly, I couldn't find a practice to buy, so I did what now is not considered recommended, but I kind of started from scratch because I couldn't find I didn't want to be an associate my whole life, and I had a college buddy of mine who was a chiropractor, and he was looking for some space, and I was looking for some space, and we said, well, we don't have a lot of money, and we don't have patients yet, so we're going to go in together, and we actually just found a space, and we kind of built out an office, and we decided that we were going to be, again, it looks like we were entrepreneurial, but we were just cutting costs. We'll split the rent, we'll split this.
Yeah.
What it developed into was very interesting, because we ended up forming what's now called a wellness center.
At the time,
it wasn't really set up that way, but other than getting adjusted once in a while, I didn't really understand a lot about chiropractic until we got in together. And that actually started, interesting part of the story, by the way, is that we were literally painting the place ourselves, and we were, and during the process, there was these shelves that were going up behind the front desk area, and I was like, well, what's that for? And he's like, it's for my products. And it was all about cervical pillows and herbs and vitamins. And I was like, oh, we don't do that. Like, I don't do that. I was taught not to do that.
I don't sell stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was kind of fascinated by it, but I was a little bit concerned about it. And the reason I bring it up is that, so after a few years together, two things happened. The first thing was we started to realize that we could really work together more on patient care than we even thought. And so we actually, our assistants and our front desk, our manager, our office manager, became well-versed in working with both dental and chiropractic. So, of course, we had different treatment rooms, but on the assistant side and on the office manager side, we shared those people.
Wow.
And then we realized that we could do things like nutrition therapy. We could work a lot on TMJ and stuff like that. So patients were getting in and having a massage or getting adjusted before they sat in the dental chair.
That's
so it was
so
really
cool.
Interesting how that turned out. So
yeah.
It was, you know, and then it became more, went along those lines. And then the other part of it was that once I saw how patients reacted to picking up things like vitamins and cervical pillows, I started to realize that what I was missing when I started the practice was, and when it got to the home care part, certain treatment plans, you know, the patients were going out and going to the stores and they weren't buying what you recommended, or even if you gave them a freebie, didn't mean it was necessarily the right system for them. So I got into the concept of understanding professional grade products and retailing in an office. At that time, only about 5% of practices did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it snowballed, learning about it, it snowballed into, I was approached by an oral hygiene company to say, well, we've got, they were the first alcohol-free mouth rinse first or second in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a little fascinated by that because I thought it was an interesting thing, and I thought there was certainly a need for it. And I started to speak for them, and I started to work with the program. And I probably would have never done that if I hadn't been in with a chiropractor, by the way. That was an interesting thing.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, I took over their whole dental division. I became the dental director, and I got into product development. I got into training all the dentists and hygienists. And I got into training the independent sales and even the consumer side.
Yeah.
So I had never expected to get into all of that stuff. And I kind of learned on the fly. And then from that point on, after getting into product development, sales, and marketing, so I'm going to try to keep it short. I wanted to give it the very beginning. And to fast forward it.
It's fascinating.
Well, I got into all that stuff, and then what ended up happening was other companies saw that I had developed products, and I got into sales training from the mindset of the dental practice. So what I learned is you can have the best product in the world, whether it's a hygiene product or a restorative, it doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
The truth is, you could say what you have on paper, you have all the studies to back it. You know, the companies have to understand how to relate to the hygienist and dentist, and they don't normally know how to do that. And no offense, I've worked now, fast forward now, over 270 manufacturers, and working with their sales teams now and understanding what I call the psychology of the dental practice. So whether it's the hygienist, the office manager, or the dentist, and I formed a program called How to Sell to Dental Offices. And this is a program now that's been going on for many years, and so I do a number of workshops around that. And that kind of snowballed into a whole bunch of things, from helping companies fill certain positions, whether they're educator or sales positions or COO positions. So I formed a recruiting division and then got into mergers and acquisitions because then there were companies that were like, okay, so you worked with us on our product lines, you worked on the sales and marketing side. Hey, we're looking to buy companies. And so everything started to snowball from there. So this is going from the late 80s up until about 2006. In 2006, I made a decision at the age of 43 or so that it was time for me to sell my practice. You know, you're at the point when your office manager says, well, when are you going to be here?
And so
that wasn't working for the patients either. So the bottom line is I made the decision to, while I now been almost 10 years, so I haven't practiced full time. I maintain my license, but I'm on really what you would call the business side of the industry. And I work with both what goes on within the practice settings, to the manufacturers, dealers, and all the other companies out there within dental, and formed a company called Connect the Dents, and realized that one of the things that was missing out there is for different sectors within the industry to get to like and know each other better, rather than as a hygienist just going to the hygiene meetings or the hygiene parties,
right,
or being a dentist doing the same, or the manufacturers not hanging out with other manufacturers. I'm like, it's okay for you guys to mingle a little bit. So we formed this thing to kind of just bring the industry together, and that's where we are right now. And so this is what I do full time.
I love it.
So. Tony's like a secret agent, though. Like, he knows so many people and so many like things, and you just kind of you connect them, and it's which is Connect the Dents.
Yeah.
So, well, I guess about that. So, what kind of traits or what are you looking for in before you make a recommendation to say manufacturer A? I have a great hygienist that would be educator or whatever. What are you looking for?
On which side?
Both sides. Start with maybe the hygienist first.
Yeah. Well, let's look at it this way. We all know hygienists who are, first of all, very, very good at what they do clinically, but also, again, have a passion for the industry.
Sure.
Now, most of them don't want to practice 5 days a week.
Yeah.
I did surveys that show 88% of hygienists want to practice 3 to 3.5 days a week. And that's great. That's okay. As many dentists are the same way. But they want to expand into other areas. And what's natural for them, when they see the manufacturers reps coming in and they go to the trade shows, what they see is, oh, I can do that. That looks great. Yeah. And I don't disagree that they could do that. But I will tell you, as a dentist that got into sales, it's different.
It's not the same.
The advantage you have, so if a hygienist says, I'd like to consider an educator or a sales position, we start with, and I have a video about this, but we start with, what are the pros and cons of getting into sales as a hygienist? Because I was telling somebody about this last night at one of our networking events. What I find is that sometimes a hygienist will look at it and say, oh, I can make more money in sales. And maybe they can. It's not a no. I already know the industry. I know the terminology. And for manufacturers, that's a positive.
Mm-hmm.
Because they bring people in from outside dental. They don't even know the difference between what does occlusal mean? What is, what's a composite resin? They don't know that stuff.
Right.
So they have to almost teach them from scratch. All they know is sales. And I always say it's the opposite with us as hygienists or dentists that are looking to do this, in that you have the terminology down. But just because you see somebody come in and they're like, oh, I have all this flexibility. I can go around. I can teach people about my products. I can do lunch and learns, all those things. Interestingly, what ends up happening is there are two things. So generally, let's say you're a hygienist, you're working in an office, you may have one boss, the dentist.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, and your relationship with that dentist is more conversation, obviously, that we can have. And it's never perfect.
Sure.
But you have technically one, you know, the hygienist is the other clinician. And so, you know, you're in a place within the office that's a pretty good place. But, you know, all right, you may moan a little bit about, oh, it's not this and that, and I like to make a little more money. But I say, when you go to a company, you work for as a manufacturer, you might have five bosses.
Yeah.
And by the way, you might be more educated than they are. And now it's a different story. It's like a whole different end. Not only that, they're saying, oh, Michelle, you're going to be our chief educator. So, you know, you love this periodontal product, and you know it well, and you're our chief educator. What they don't tell you is, oh, by the way, and you find this out after you get the job, you've got to also get new accounts. You're not just educating. You have to sell, too.
Right.
And a lot of times you don't know this stuff up front, or you're not clear as what that means for my salary and my bonuses and all those things. So we try to work, you know, with hygienist A's to give them a pretty good understanding of what might it be like, whether it's part-time or full-time as an educator. You know, what does that look like? And then from the manufacturer side, I want them to be more open-minded, and I'll be very, very honest about this. A lot of them won't hire hygienists.
Why?
Because they don't think they're good salespeople. They know they know terminology, but they and the truth is, if they hired 100 hygienists without the hygienist having a little bit of sales training, because they do know the terminology, they're probably right. Then they're not all going to be good sales. It's not going to be a very high percentage, but in general, sales is not a high percentage situation anyway.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are very close-minded because years ago they hired a few hygienists and there was this. And I always say, well, part of it is you haven't given them the right job description. You're telling them they're educators and they're, you want them to be salespeople. Those are two. They overlap. Don't get me wrong. And so, but you can have great educators who can't sell, and you have great salespeople can't educate. And hygienists, in most cases, need to be both. And so I can handle the sales part of it and all that. I want them to be upfront with the hygienist.
Mm. Yeah.
And I say to them, here's the way I look at it. Yeah, you're not going to have 100% of hygienists that are going to be great in sales. But if you give them the right job description and you're honest with them up front, the sales part can be easily taught, okay? And the second part is, why would you close the doors to all the hygienists? Like, what do you mean you won't hire hygienists? And I give them five examples of companies or 10. I could say, I could name 10 manufacturers right now that have 50 salespeople. And out of the top five, out of those 50, three of them are hygienists. And all of a sudden, they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah, so why are you closed about this?
Yeah.
You know, why would you be closed? You know, what I can help them with is, I have a pretty, whether it's a hygienist or another sales, I have a pretty good idea of working with them after a short period of time of whether they would be a good person. So the manufacturers now try to come to me again as the connector and rely on me on, hey, they take your program, you've worked with them before, and I can give them a pretty good assessment of, yeah, that RDH should be an advantage after their name. And I can say this one would be better than that one, but just don't come to me and say I won't hire someone who's a dental clinician, because, you know, that's not always the case. You should be more open about it.
Nice.
So what are the things when the hygienists are coming to you, what types of jobs are they looking for? Is it always sales, or is it always education, or is it like a bigger range?
Well, we get a good number that they get fascinated by sales, and it's because of being in the office when you see the reps walking in.
Sure.
They look, I don't want to use the word glamorous. They look at it like, yeah, it's pretty cool, and they do, and I get it. I mean, they don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, they got the quotas, and they're driving around all over the place, and you know, they're staying in these little rinky-dink hotels on the way of
they
wherever.
They see they go to Vegas and they have a party.
Right. Well, they see one side of it, and I get all that. But
so
a lot of them come to me initially for sales, and I just say let's do an initial assessment, and that's why I put together a video, which is on my Dental Sales Academy website, that you can learn a little bit more about, like, what are the pros and cons, what are you getting yourself into. But to answer your question, I find many of them are just as fascinated with, you know, becoming a consultant. And consulting's, Google dental practice management or dental consultant, you're going to get like 300,000 responses.
Right.
So that's a very broad thing. But some of them want to get into consulting. Some of them want to get into speaking. And some of them want to get into product development. Or they want to work as a director of professional relations or academic affairs or, you know, consumer affairs for a company. You know, and I'm using, like, you know, we all know the big companies out there.
Right.
You know, the Colgates of the world. They all have numerous positions that a hygienist certainly could fill. But those positions are not sitting on the table every day.
Right.
And, again, they have their advantages and disadvantages. So what's happened over the years is they're coming and they're saying, well, I'm thinking about sales. I'm thinking about consulting. I'd like to get in front of the stage and, I'm like, well, you know, I'll say that's great. Now you can get in front of the stage in front of 10 people, or there's a difference between working with 10 people and 500 people.
Yes.
And if you've ever spoken in front of 500 people, it is not easy to do.
No.
Yeah. And I don't like to do it. I used to do it years ago. I stay with small groups now is what I like. But I will say that, you know, they want to know more about their options. Mm. So one of the things that came as a result of that was we looked at the industry and we said, is there anything out there for hygienists and dentists in particular to learn about those options without feeling like they would be in directed because of a sponsorship or they would be restricted in what they could ask or find out about? There's really nothing out there like that. So there are some that are, you know, out there that teach you a little bit about just speaking, or, you know, if you want to become a hygienist, maybe become a KOL down the road. You have some stuff out there, and it's all good and fine. But we were getting inquiries from hygienists and from dentists saying, what's out there?
Right.
Like, what's the overview? Right. So we formed a workshop called Beyond the Operatory, and we did that about 8 to 10 years ago. And I say we, so I have the two of you are kind of partners in this. I have a partner, a woman who was an office manager for many years, who speaks on the circuit a lot about all different things, insurance. And we looked at each other's resumes one day, and we were sitting around, might have been the Chicago Midwinter, or might have been RDH Under One Roof at one point. And we said, you know, you've done everything in the industry that I haven't done, but we've covered it between the two of us.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we said, right, like kind of like you guys, right? Yeah. So the compatibility was, okay, so what can we do about this? And, you know, we're sitting there, and I'm having my beer, and she's having her glass of wine. And we said, okay, so you're probably being asked by people all the time, like, can I pick your brain? You ever get that? Can I pick your brain?
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I don't want anybody to know, you know, I don't want to take up too much time. And, of course, then it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And but they want to know, like, how did you do what you did and all these things? So Beyond the Operatory was, why don't we form these small group workshops where we don't take sponsorship money? It's not CE or anything like that. It is an overview of everything that's outside the office, whether non-clinical. So there are 5 major categories. There's about 20 different areas that we cover. And this whole program is only a day and a half. So we spend really the first day going through all the options. And we tell them to be open because they fill out a questionnaire. So a hygienist may come and they say, okay, I'm interested right now in sales, or I'm interested in consulting. And then by the end of it, they're like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Uh-huh. You know, so what ends up happening, we want to give them an overview and just say, be open about the course. And then our role then is for them to put together a game plan. It may not be tomorrow. And it's also, I want to clarify, it's not to get them out of clinical, because many of them, like, again, we get a mix of dentists and hygienists, even a few office managers. Many of them want to stay part-time or full-time, but they just want one little income stream or one little thing to break up the monotony of being chairside every day or whatever. Some of them come and say, I want out. Like, I
am done.
But I'm a dentist or a hygienist. I don't know anything else. Like, what else is out there? So they come in with this, like, I don't know where to go. Or some of them come in, I have an idea where to go, but I'm not sure what this means. So what we do with the workshop is we do the overview, and you can ask any question you want. So if you're a hygienist, now I don't know anybody in the industry that does this, where a hygienist can sit down and say, so Tony.
He thinks I'm singing.
they can sit down and say, so Tony, what kind of salary can I make working for a manufacturing company? Or, you know, how do I negotiate a consulting contract?
Or shouldn't I work for?
What's it like working for XYZ company?
Yes.
And nobody, you can't do that in a regular dental. They're going to be like, I can't say that here.
Yeah.
Well, we can say that. You know, we're not taking, we take a tuition for it.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's, we're not looking we're not looking to make a lot of money on it other than we're giving you our time and our expertise in the industry. But we want them to be able to ask those questions. Like, I see these hygienists doing this.
Mm-hmm.
What does that really mean? You know, so we're able to do that. And I think that's what makes it special. And then the idea is, whether it's tomorrow or 6 months from now, we can then, if they come back and say, the only thing I want to do is get into product development for a hygiene company, and I'll say to them, fine, you're on the list with us, and when something hits, we'll have you,
we'll let you know,
as a recommendation. Now, if they come and say, you know, I'd like to do some speaking, or I'd like to work for a consulting company, then we'll connect them. Or maybe they want to affiliate with an organization. Let's say a nonprofit dental organization, which we get sometimes. You know, I was the external relations director of Oral Health America as well. So I've worked for dental nonprofits, so I can give some guidance on that. You know, and you know, they'll say, oh, what about a nonprofit? Well, what about working with this? So what we do is afterwards, between Teresa, who's my partner with this, and myself, we do connect them. We'll introduce them to an organization, association, a manufacturer, whatever, a consulting company, whatever it may be, and we do our best. We can't guarantee anything, because sure. It's impossible to do that. But we try to do our best for them to cut out the period, because they get excited about something now, and now it's a matter of, well, okay, I might be in the industry 20 years, and I'm a hygienist that's excited about getting into consulting, but now what? You know, you take a CE program on some new procedure, you get in Monday morning, and you're excited. The rest of the team may not be yet.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, my gosh, my schedule is too tight today. I can't do anything. 3 weeks go by, you haven't done a thing.
I know.
And it's the same thing with this. So whether, you know, and you guys see this all the time. So we wanted to cut that out and see if we can be a little more hands-on with, you know, saying, yeah, we're going to charge a tuition, but we don't want you to be on your own afterwards.
And I took the How to Sell to Dentist course, and that was
eye-opening. How to Sell a Dentist course is different than
Beyond the operatory. Yeah, because How to Sell a Dentist is really, I mean, it's for
Michelle.
Michelle's probably not even on the mainstream of that. She's on a little bit on the outside, but it's anybody that does you do some sales, but I mean that's not your full time gig,
right?
But it's anybody that sells anything. So it could be a practice management consultant, it could be a lab owner, it could be a manufacturer's rep, it could be a CEO of a startup company. You know, it could be someone already in sales, a marketing director. Any of those people would take that program.
It's eye opening. Eye opening.
Why is it eye opening?
Just things that you don't think about. Like for me going in, even though I'm not sales, maybe I'm on the the trade shows. You know, I'm on the floor and I'm saying the same shit that every other person's saying, and not even realizing I'm saying it.
Well, I think
you want to be unique.
So it's kind of a way to just make your brain think differently and approach dentists in a way that's going to...
I think with someone like Michelle, I had said beforehand, what you're going to get out of this is not doing brain surgery here. Mm-hmm. Right. What it is it's designed to understand the psychology of the people in the practice. Yes, the dentist, but not just the dentist, the hygienist, the office manager, right, the gatekeeper. So the truth is, most companies or most consultants, as we talked about, they go into an office, they ask the same exact questions.
Yes.
Or they go in saying, we're the best of this.
Sure.
We have the best, you know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm sitting there as the dentist, or the hygienist is like, okay, but the guy yesterday said exactly the same thing to me. So now you're already like, that doesn't help the trust factor, because not everybody could be the best. It's all subjective in most cases. And there's a lot of really good products on the dental market. It's not like that product sucks and this product's, you know. So what happens is, what I teach the course from is really, there are certain questions or words that drive dentists and hygienists crazy.
Yeah.
And little words that change the conversation right up front. So what we focus on is what I call the psychology of what turns them on, what turns them off, what's important to them, why they buy and don't buy. And it is eye-opening to people that take it, because it's simple concepts.
Sure.
But the concepts are generally not done, not because you're not a good salesperson, but because you're taught with your company or in previous experiences that, you know, what you do is you ask a question. Most of the questions are blatant setup questions.
Yeah.
And I know that as a dentist.
Leading in,
You know, we almost say to ourselves, oh, I know why you're asking that. Or you put them in a position which is either uncomfortable or it forces them to get defensive. Now, how does that work? It doesn't usually work in sales, does it? So that's what that course is designed for. You know, and Beyond the Operatory is totally different, because Beyond the Operatory talks about sales as an option, but just as one of many different areas that you might want to go into. How to sell dental offices. Very often, for example, someone might come to Beyond the Operatory, and then they may take the How to Sell a Dentist down the road.
Gotcha.
That's a possibility. You know.
How do different education levels fit as far as hygienists taking your courses? Like, where do you see them going? Or do you see, like, one education, having a master's is better than an AS or whatever?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, and this is a thing that it can be a little bit troublesome at times. Because, like, for instance, if you're a hygienist and you want to get into sales, or you want to get into a... I want to say the word corporate position. But let's say you want to work for a manufacturer, you want to be the director of, you know, consumer affairs or whatever it is. They're going to have minimum requirements. So if you don't have a bachelor's minimum, you can't even apply. I can speak to them until I'm blue in the face and say, you know, Michelle has her associates and she's kick ass. Am I allowed to say that?
Oh yeah.
I'm kidding. I'm a New Yorker anyway, so I can say these things, but that's, I'm not going to go much beyond
that.
Right. I know that. I've listened to your other podcasts, so I know.
Can't go four sentences without cussing.
But I could say Michelle's the kick-ass person. That's perfect for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a minimum requirement. There's nothing you can do about it. It actually works with the dentist, too. I mean, all right, the dentists have a DDS or a DMD degree, but there are some positions that dentists want to go into, and you need a master's or you need an MBA as well.
Yeah,
and I'm like, you know what? Your doctorate is not good enough here. So it goes both ways. But yeah, sometimes you come up against that. So all different people take my courses. But generally speaking, for sales positions and stuff, you know, I think a hygienist that has advanced degrees and everything like that probably isn't going to be a great fit necessarily just to be a territory rep. They probably can go to a different type of position.
Sure.
Nothing wrong. We need the territory reps and we need the sales reps. But there are times when that whole thing about being overqualified or underqualified certainly comes into play.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that makes sense.
Do you feel like a lot of the people that take your course have unrealistic expectations of salary, of what they want? Like, I'm going to get out of the op so I can make this much money.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say
you're on fire today, Andrew.
No, that's a great question
because
I love it. No, it really is because there are when you say unrealistic, it goes both ways with that as well. I think most of them, if let's say a hygienist wants to go into sales, I think they think the base salary is going to be higher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Most of the manufacturer's reps, when you're going, you know, if you're going to become a full-time salesperson for a manufacturer, most of them are not paying you $100,000 in base.
No.
Right.
You may think that's what it looks like, but that's very unusual. You know, you're going to be way below that. Now, you're going to have a lot of, you know, you have all your benefits and you have bonus plans and all these things. But even with that, I try to be realistic with them on, because I say, oh, but I talk to this manufacturer and they say, well, I could easily in my first year make $120,000. Well, uh-huh. You can, but it's not going to happen your first year.
Right.
It's very rare that you're going to be able to start making that kind of money right away. Now, on the other side of that, if you're working where it's not, let's say, a territory position where it's just a sales, where you're dealing a lot with bonuses and commissions, but if you're doing a full time and you let's say you have a master's or bachelor's degree and you're looking at a director or something for a company, mm-hmm. I think some of them are surprised at those base salaries are generally higher than what people think.
Sorry to put you on point, but about what?
No,
what
I mean they range like tremendously.
Well, would they be like $60,000 as your base, or are they going to be like $90,000, $100,000?
Well, yeah. So let's say you get into director or something, or you're a VP of sales or a marketing director. And those can really, really vary depending on the size of the company. But it's not unusual to see a lot of six-figure bases in some of those positions, mm-hmm. and then you're certainly tied into other things for bonuses. So it is a very different thing. But when it comes to like a sales position or a territory rep, generally I think they're expecting it to be a little higher. So I always talk about the whole thing where, you know, hygienists, if they work full time, certainly make a good living.
Yeah.
Financially. Look, everybody's underpaid. So you can argue this until we can argue this all day long, you know, and, you know, dentists are underpaid too in a lot of ways. And like, you know, talk numbers.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, you know, we can get into that, but a lot of hygienists or people that work in the industry, sales reps think dentists make a lot more money than they make.
Right.
You know, they're being taught by the companies that, oh yeah, you know, whatever. They're operating at pretty high overheads.
Being cheap is
it's all of that combined into this thing where they have a certain perception. So the perception, if you get on the other side of the industry, from you're going from an office into, let's say, a business position, a clinical, a position with a manufacturer or anything like that, I think a lot of them thinking, okay, I'm going to make a lot more than they do as a hygienist. And base-wise, that's probably not the case.
Right.
Again, there's upside. You know, one of the downsides of being a hygienist is that you're going to hit an income ceiling in most offices mm-hmm. fairly yeah. quickly after a few years. Yeah. So you could be a hygienist out 2 years and 20 years and you're making the same amount.
Sure.
And is that fair? Well, probably not. But within the confines of a practice running at 70%
right.
overhead, there's some wiggle room there, but there's not a lot. So
right.
you are sometimes hitting a ceiling. So yeah, in that case, you've been a hygienist 15 years and you're passionate about the industry and all these things. And you're making a decent living, but you're also, your hands hurt and your back hurts and some other things are going on. And you want to look at another option, that's fine. The advantage sometimes in looking non-clinical or at least part-time, there is an upside where you can break through it. But if you're expecting, Michelle, I'm going to hire you. Here's $150,000, mm-hmm. like your first year base. That is really not happening.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
not happening. So
totally.
We only have like
yeah.
almost no minutes left.
All right, good.
So I got one more thing for
sure.
you, though. What is it? I mean, because Michelle mentioned it earlier. Like, what is it about hygienists that you just love? Like, what's the draw?
Well, I think the obvious draw is that they're, you know, I don't want to say this in a bad way. They're not really forced into the business side of the industry as much because it's not fun. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. And you know what? Most dentists, when I ask dentists, why do you like being a dentist or why did you get into dentistry? Most of them, they're not saying, I want to make a lot of money. And like, there's a few percent that do. Mm-hmm. Most of them, they don't want to deal with that administration. They don't want to look at those numbers. They just want to do dentistry.
Right.
And that's what hygienists, first of all, they have that additional passion. So they actually have, in some ways, they even have, they're much more apt to look at those studies mm-hmm. and read them, you know, and you took my course. I mean, I even talk about, I've experimented with sending dentists a bunch of studies and it was like blank pages. It was an abstract and there was nothing behind it, knowing that the dentist probably wasn't going to read it anyway. Now, don't get me wrong. My colleagues out there, there are a lot of them that they certainly do their whatever, sure. but they don't sit around reading studies all day.
Right.
And not that every hygienist does, but the hygienist is generally much more concerned overall about the end result on the health status of the patient. Mm-hmm. The dentist has to worry about how does this fit into a lot of things. And so the reputation then becomes, does the dentist really care about patient care? We've had conversations about, I say the answer is yes, but I say that there are other factors that, well, sure. first of all, you're better at what you do than the dentist is. And I do agree with that. Dentists can certainly do some of what you do, but that's not the point. The point is they have a whole bunch of other stuff going on and they're distracted because of that. And generally speaking, you are the specialist in what you do, but you're also, ultimately, what you want to see is the patient, every time you see the patient, getting healthier.
Right.
And the dentist, and, you know, I'm going to segue into this. I know we're almost out of time, but
you go as long as you need to go.
Well, I've had this conversation with Michelle before. If you're going to ask the question, and you said, what do you love about hygienists?
Yeah.
Hygienists aren't concerned about right up front. They're not generally concerned about, is this patient going to say no because it's too expensive? Is the insurance going to cover it? You know, am I going to work too hard on this? They don't do that.
Right.
I mean, some of them do, but most of them don't.
Yeah, most of them.
The problem with the dentist and the hygiene department, we've talked about this over and over. The dentist is always kind of like, okay, I've got to keep my patients. I can't piss off my patients. I've got to make money too, but I'm not. So they're in this like weird position. Like, how do I make this work? But they also don't want to be the bad guy.
Right.
And then you know what it's like. So one of you are in there and this patient needs quad work and they've got to, you know, you've got to work up this. They have active disease. You've got to do something about it. And it's fairly obvious, or even if it's borderline, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because if it's borderline, it's going to still progress in most cases. You know,
sure.
you know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the worst thing that the dentist does always is they come in and they say, let's keep an eye on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're the expert as the hygienist, but the dentist doesn't want to be the bad guy either. And then, you know, so too many dentists still do that. Yeah. I think it's changing a little bit, but too many of them still do that. And that doesn't work. So that's something that we still have to work on and work hard on. But, you know, hygienists don't think that way. They think about this is what's going on and this is what is needed. And that other stuff, we'll figure that out. Or I'm not, yeah. you know, I'm, yeah. This is what the patient, mm-hmm. you know, this is what they want and need right now.
Right.
So
I love it. It's a good answer.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I told you.
You told me. You did tell me. You're right.
Any other questions?
So yeah, but I mean, I'm good for now.
So many. contact stuff, like where they can find you, how they look into these things, the video, so dentalsalesacademy.com?
Yeah, so, dentalsalesacademy.com, connectthedents.com. That one's probably, you know, that's a lot, very business-oriented, that site. And then beyondtheoperatory.com, if you want to learn about the different courses. I would urge anybody listening, please connect with me on LinkedIn. I do a lot of work on LinkedIn, make a lot of announcements about different programs and events and stuff like that we do. I also have a big Facebook group of well over a couple thousand people called Dental Entrepreneurs, plural.
You're not on that, are you?
I'm not on that.
So Dental Entrepreneurs, plural. Dental Entrepreneur, which is fine, is a publication. And I urge you to get on that group as well because Ann Duffy, my good hygienist friend from Charlotte, runs Dental Entrepreneur magazine. But this group is called Dental Entrepreneurs. So please, if you're active on Facebook, I would urge you private group. So I would just, as long as you have a dental background, I'll let you in.
Let you in.
Okay. We get a lot of people trying to break into that group. I'm like, no, I'm looking at this thing. I don't know what you're trying to do here, but no, can't do that.
Nice. So, okay. Awesome. thanks for taking
Thank you so much.
You know, they don't know you unless they know you. Like, but you're like losing your voice because you're day five of Chicago Midwinter. You had a kick-ass party last night, and Tony and I are drinking partners.
Yeah,
too.
Well, she's gonna teach me. I don't know. I just gotta learn the wine stuff. I've tried a few times. I've got to figure out the wine thing because you know.
But I still drink beer, so I'll drink beer.
I give you credit about that, but we don't drink the same beers either, so we have to work on that.
I don't drink the heavy beers anymore because
I'm afraid I'm going to get fat. Yeah, I'm IPA. You're afraid what?
I'll get fat.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. This is the problem when you know, I've got a lot of years on you, Michelle. So that's the problem with loving beer.
I know.
That's the issue.
But I'll drink it every night. I love some craft beer, but...
Michelle will learn you about wines.
I'm going to learn you about wines and stuff. We tried one the other night that wasn't the best. That was not a good kickoff point for us.
Yeah,
I'm going to do it again.
I was okay with it, but I knew I wasn't going to, you know, I wasn't probably going to go back there anyway. So,
Well, thanks. All right. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
It's been good information.
Thank you.
Listeners, I want to tell you a story. A story I found on the web. Which makes this Scaling the Web with Andrew. All right, so this week on Scaling the Web, I went to a website called dentalbuzz.com. Have you heard of dentalbuzz.com?
Yep, I have.
Dentalbuzz,
I'm not really sure why.
A jolt of current, trends, innovations, and quirks of dentistry. That's what it's called. I have a friend, her name's Trish Walraven, and I hope I'm saying her name right, but she was a friend from Hygiene Town way back when, and I think it was Mark Frias who decided to get us all on the same panels and started talking about stuff way back when, too, a couple years, 3 years ago maybe, something like that.
I also want to give a shout out to her because she was one of the, when I discovered the Crest Blue Flex.
Yes.
That I wrote an article. She and one other person were the only ones that I could find any kind of research on. And she did her own little experiment. And I thought that was so cool. So you're awesome.
And she was interviewed by a lot of media people about that too. Yeah, she is fantastic. But I think one of the things I appreciate most about her is her writing style. She is kind of anecdotal, but also does have some research and evidence and thought put into it. And I think the article I chose from her, which is a recent article from March 15th, 2017, it talks about kind of the problems that they're having in Texas right now. So it's entitled Should Dental Hygienists Give Shots? And I won't go over all of it because I want you guys to read it. It's not really long, but it's longer than probably we have tonight. She says the one really, really important thing. It says, and yet anyone who has had significant dental treatment performed has allowed someone to inject their mouth with a needle, right? We've all accepted the fact that shots are so much better than the actual thing that we hate going to the dentist. Pain. Pain is what we really hate. And shots, they make pain go bye-bye. No shot. You're all knowing in a very bad way about every little thing that's getting fixed in your mouth. But with the shots, you don't have all that. So she's talking about that. She says in Texas and five other states, the hygienist can't give shots. Dental hygienist education in regards to anesthetic delivery is considered inferior, and therefore allowing hygienists to stick a needle in a patient's mouth allegedly places the public in unnecessary danger. On this map, and you guys can see a map, it says, you'll see red states with years next to their abbreviations. And these are the states that allow hygienists to give shots, along with the dates when administration and licensing first became available. So, this is the difference. I love this map because it does have the dates on there too. It's not just a red and a gray map and then we're good to go. And then her argument later on, and this is why you should continue reading this article, says, do I think that Texas should allow hygienists to give shots just because everyone else is doing it? No. And then she explains her stance. But I want to do this with you. I would like you to tell me, hold on, let me find you real quick. What year did you guys start allowing anesthetic in your state?
Wait, let me think. 2002?
1995.
Oh, wow. Really?
That's what it says. That's what it says.
Okay, wait. If I graduated... Oh, okay, okay. I totally did that. Okay, if I graduated in 05...
Yeah, your math sucks. Okay, so let's do another one. Let's do... according to this map, what state has been allowed to give anesthetic the longest?
Ooh.
And then what's the number two state? And I'm sorry if I get this wrong, because it's not actually a numerical order, but...
California, I would think number one.
You know, they actually weren't. I think they were...
Really?
Yeah, they were probably number four or five or somewhere in there. They were in 1976.
Colorado?
Colorado was after them in 1977.
Mm.
Idaho actually was in 1975, so they beat California even.
Idaho.
Isn't that crazy?
Good job, Idaho.
Yeah.
Okay, and then number two would be California?
No, California is like number five. Or something like that.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
So Idaho was what, 70 what?
75 was when Idaho did theirs.
Any of the northeastern states in that? Or is it all just kind of
it's western,
Midwest?
It's western.
To
western. I'll give you western. Yeah. Washington. I'll just give you
so Idaho.
Washington's
then,
number one.
Is it Washington?
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
1971.
Oh, I thought you were saying Idaho is the number
no,
one.
No.
Sorry.
Idaho is 75. Washington was 71. Oregon was also 75. The number two state, New Mexico, 1972 is when they could give it.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
How many hygienists have killed patients with anesthetic?
Zero. Am I right?
You know, probably because
y'all should look at this map though, because it's funny because you look at the Northeast and in no particular order, but I'm kind of starting Northeast, like with Maine. They were 97, but then there's 2002, 2004, 2001, 2005, 2008, 2009, 2009, 2004, 2006, 2003, 2006, 2002, 2008, 2002, 2012. 2009 was Maryland and
really?
Pennsylvania. Looks like
slow pokes the yeah. East Coast.
Yeah. But then you look at the West Coast, 71, 75, 76, 82, 75, 83, 76, 72, 77, 85, then 91. Oh, and then Alaska was 81 and Hawaii was 87.
This is why I think that it would be so freaking wonderful if we could all just come together. Let's bring us all to the same tier before we start progressing other states.
Yeah, that's a whole different scaling the web, though. But you are right. We do need to get there eventually.
It is.
All right, and that's it.
Because
that's all. That's all for scaling the web.
Good
the
job.
End.
The end.
It's about that time. Grab your blanket and a glass of wine. It's story time with Michelle.
So for this week on Storytime with Michelle, I'm doing a little something different. Instead of reading from a journal, I'm going to read from a book, and I'm going to take a chapter a week. I'm not reading you the whole chapter, so calm down.
And she's going to be sober while she does this. That's the other different part. No?
Oh, but I had wine
no,
already.
Okay, so maybe not.
Have you missed me drinking my wine?
Sorry, I was looking at my computer stuff instead. I should have been paying more attention to your wine drinking.
Come on. Let's be realistic.
I should have been able to hear it clinking on your teeth or on the desk or something.
Slurping. Slurp. So I have this book that I bought from Quintessence. I have a problem buying books when I go to any of the meetings where Quintessence or Wiley or anybody that has like the stand and I walk across them. And one of them was our past guest last week, Julie Hawley, her book. I think everyone should get that. It's truly, it's so informative. It really
is. And it was a wildly, by the way, wildly popular episode. So if you haven't downloaded that episode, first of all, you should be subscribed. But two, go back and download that one and listen to it right away. Sorry.
Oh, it was so good. It was so good.
Yeah.
I got things that I didn't even think I... I'm not... Okay, moving on. Sorry. So this book is called Communication Skills for Dental Healthcare Providers.
I like it.
And I thought that there was a lot of little
good tidbits in each chapter. We just actually did an interview last week that has a whole chapter kind of on it. And so I'm going to wait until that launches to do that chapter. But this is by Young, O'Toole, and Wolf. And so I figured I'd really just kind of start off with the preface and kind of get that out of the way so that you can, I kind of get an idea of what the following weeks are going to come. But there's like communication fundamentals. There's how to talk to patients with anxiety. There's even things about dentists and their stereotypes and the different types there are, which I found really interesting. I know. I'm excited for this. So each week we're going to kind of just tackle this until I get bored with it.
Sound good? That sounds great. Oh, I'll probably stay away for these ones too. That'd be great.
Okay, so over the past 10 years, the three authors of this book have taught patient-provider communication skills to dental students at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. Oh, shout out to, isn't this where Emily Bogie went? University of Iowa?
She's from Iowa.
Hopefully.
I just don't know. I promise I was paying attention.
So, I know. All those states, I get confused. In addition to our academic training, each of us has different real-world experience ranging from clinical dentist, O'Toole, to health insurance, Wolf, and to business marketing, Young. We therefore recognize the value of basing practical decisions on sound research. Recent years have been tremendous growth in research on communication between dental professionals and their patients. Individually and collectively, however, we've been frustrated by the lack of single resource presenting the most reliable and recent evidence to suggest how dental providers should interact with their patients. In developing and refining our curricula at the university, we located four books published within the previous 30 years that addressed communication to the dental setting. Although each text has its strengths, they all lack recent evidence-based findings to support the communication practices they recommend. The communication patterns and expectations of patients have changed over time, so research conducted in the 1970s and 80s may be less reliable than research conducted more recently. Further, demographic changes have resulted in patient diversity unknown to previous generations of oral health professionals. Hence why I thought this was a really good one. Mm-hmm. Diversity challenges current dental providers to develop flexible communication skills. Scripted communication will not work. The lack of dental communication textbook left us scoring research journals for information we believed our students should know before they began practicing on patients. Having received positive feedback on the curricula we developed, we wrote this manual so that other dental professionals may benefit from our work. Because we exclusively teach future dentists, our focus in writing has been patient-dentist communication. We can think of a few instances, however, in which evidence-based communication skills described in this book do not also apply to dental auxiliaries, including dental hygienists, dental therapists, or dental assistants. We are familiar with one text addressing communication for dental auxiliaries, but it was published 30 years ago and is long out of print. My dog is whining. What do you want from me? Go lay down somewhere. I love you. Until another such book is published, we feel comfortable recommending our manual for dental auxiliaries who want to improve their skills in communicating with patients. Throughout this manual, we typically refer to the dental or oral health providers and professionals, implying every member of the dental team, but particularly the dentist. The dental students we teach have completed an undergraduate degree, so most of them have taken at least one course in communication studies, which I think should be a part of dental hygiene, 100%.
Sure. We had to.
Similarly, yeah.
Yeah, we did.
I don't feel like I did. I took psychology and sociology, but...
We did those too.
And speaking. Does that all that count?
No.
Like you had a dental communications class?
It wasn't dental communications, it was communications. There's a communications course.
I feel like that might have been like one of those things that I could have chosen another thing and I probably chose something different. Who needs to communicate? I have great communication skills.
Hear it right now.
Lola, for the love of mercy, I'm doing a podcast.
She just told you though.
Yeah, she did. All right. Similarly, dental auxiliaries may have taken a communication course during or after high school. Therefore, this manual is written for readers with a basic understanding of communication theory and skills. We assume, for instance, that a reader advised to make eye contact does not need to be told how many seconds of eye contact are appropriate. Do you know that answer?
No, I don't.
I don't either. But you had that communication class there, Andrew.
I don't remember the eye contact question. You should know that answer.
We encourage readers who need more basic instruction and culturally appropriate communication to make an introductory course in communication. Research into the dental provider-patient communication is growing rapidly, yet it still lags behind research into patient or physician-patient communication. The two contexts share many similarities, yet we are aware that they are not identical. In seeking research to support the skills we advocate for dental professionals, we attempt to locate recent articles using dentists or dental hygienists as participants. When such research has not been conducted, we rely on communication research, such as other medical professions, or physicians or nurses. All such research is cited. In areas where research has not been conducted or is inconclusive, recommendations are based on clinical experience, observation, and feedback from dentists, professors, and students. Such recommendations are experience-based and have no citations. All three authors have completed extensive coursework in public health and highly value the behavioral change theories in which so much patient-provider communication research is grounded. Given the considerable demands on the time of the dental students and professionals to whom this book is targeted, we have opted to write it as a practical manual instead of a comprehensive textbook. We therefore focus on specific communication skills and strategies rather than the theory underlying them. The research cited throughout the book includes material that will appeal to those interested in exploring theories on health behavior. Research suggests that much patient-provider communication training is not grounded in evidence. We wrote this book as a practical manual introducing dental students and professionals to evidence-based suggestions for effective patient communication. The manual consists of four parts. Part one presents fundamental communication skills. Part two presents those skills as they are applied in specific types of patient interactions. Part three presents chairside strategies to facilitate communication with patients during each stage of a regular appointment. And part five, Part four presents situations that sometimes challenge dental professionals and offers communication strategies for managing such challenges. So I think that would be really cool. I might go through part one, kind of just quickly skimming through it, and then get to some of the challenges and give some of the case scenarios so we can kind of talk that through.
That'd be awesome.
I think that it's huge, and I think it's not only good for, and we talked about this last week with Julie, it's not only good for what we can do with our patients, mm-hmm. but also how we can talk to each other within our office, which I think is a huge problem. You sent me that screenshot of a hygienist arguing with an assistant about putting air, water, syringes, disposable ones, and cold sterile,
yeah.
Which I think you knew would get under my skin.
I knew it. But, of course, you'd already seen it. And you were already pissed about it, so that was good.
I did. I was like, I have to keep scrolling. That was the week that I was like, I have to get off Facebook. I can't handle stupid this week.
Yeah.
Like my patience level is, and not just stupid of person posting it or the comments underneath it, but stupid of the people that they're interacting with. It makes me very sad that that's a thing. It makes me scared for patients.
Yeah.
It makes me scared to go into medical practices and think that I put my trust in all these people mm-hmm. and hoping that they're doing the right thing and not half-assing sterilization.
Mm-hmm. I have so much more to tell you off air. Though about that, anyways.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to the book stuff though. I think maybe we can figure out a way to
switching it up.
Yeah, I kind of like it. Well, I think that's what the listeners want too. They don't want to keep listening. I mean, we might cut out my segment just so we can listen to more of your story. It'd be great. So I don't have to do as much work.
Maybe we can do role playing. I'll create a script.
Hey, they just said, didn't you read? We just read that. It said we don't do scripting or whatever.
That's true.
I want to talk about that too, but we can talk about it later.
Sometimes to help. All right.
For role play.
Well, thanks everyone. I hope you have a great week and enjoy this episode.
Bye.
Bye, y'all. Bye.